The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coronomics, the Spectator series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. Today's podcast features our panel, based around the world, who have selected a story that gives you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. Peter Griffin is reporting from New Zealand and a science commentator for the New Zealand Herald. Cindy Yu is the Spectator's broadcast editor, based in the UK and reporting on China. And later in the podcast, we're joined by Jennifer Creary, reporting from Hong Kong and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. So Cindy and Peter, a big welcome to you. Cindy, let's start with your article this week, which is in Bloomberg, about a potential vaccine on the way. Now, if it proves correct and the vaccine really has potential to work, this could not just be good news for China, but for the rest of the world. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so my article is from Bloomberg, talks about Sinovac, which is one of the five vaccine candidates that is going on in China and getting into pretty mature stages of the vaccine development now. Sinovac has just recently signed a deal with a Brazilian company in order to test their vaccine in a final phase in Brazil. Obviously, as we know from the Oxford study here in the UK, you need to test this final phase where there's a lot of community transmission. In China, it doesn't exist anymore, although there are huge questions over this past weekend over whether or not we're seeing the beginnings of a second wave in Beijing. But in terms of community transmission, Sinovac is going to Brazil next month. So far in the previous trials, it's been going well. If it passes this next phase, it thinks that it can be rolling out vaccines by the end of the year. But I just thought it was a very interesting development and brings to light some of the tensions and pressures on the Chinese government to get this vaccine going. The coronavirus came from China. There's huge questions about how much the central government knew before it let the world know and how much delay that caused and suffering that may have been prevented otherwise. So the Chinese government sees a vaccine as a sort of way of not necessarily absolving guilt, but definitely just diffusing some of the tension that the world community is definitely feeling, some of the anger is feeling at China. And especially if it can get a vaccine off and running to developing countries, then even if it doesn't persuade any Western hawks, China hawks, on the efficacy of Chinese development and science and all this sort of stuff, then at least it will pull some developing countries, perhaps countries in Africa or Latin America, to its side in what is potentially a coming geopolitical fallout.
Cindy, that's really interesting because you're not just focusing on the public health aspect there. To get a vaccine, a working vaccine, would have huge implications, obviously, worldwide for public health. But you're also talking about the geopolitical aspect. And at the moment, there is a real race to get a vaccine all over the world. All different universities and pharmaceutical companies are working together to get this done. Do you think if China were to get the vaccine, do you think that could really change opinions that have formed about China in the last few months? Or do you think, if anything, it could cause more tensions?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that within China, in the last 20 years, there have been numerous scandals in medicines and in food products where major manufacturers, with the sort of blind eye of regional officials in government, you know, who were bribed by these companies, putting out basically either dud medicines, or there was a very famous milk powder incident of the early noughties where harmful milk formula was sold as real milk formula, which led to babies being stunted in their growth. So in China, there is a public health skepticism. The WHO is meant to be giving a pre-qualification stamp of approval for anything that does actually get to be used in humans on a wide level. But then the WHO itself, its credibility has been eroded in this. So I think that'll be really interesting to see what would happen if China really is the first one to develop a vaccine. I would hope that if it actually works, that geopolitics wouldn't get into the way of actually vaccinating people. But these questions do remain. It just depends on what country you're looking at. I think China has had a better reputation in some countries in this crisis than others. In the last season, we talked to Silvio about Italy's experience of China and their partnership with China on this, which is completely different to the American experience, for example. So I think it does depend on which country as well.
Yeah, interesting your view, Cindy, on, you know, this race that is happening. We've got Moderna is moving along. We've got AstraZeneca in the UK is doing stuff. So everyone is heading towards stage three trials of this. Say that maybe the Americans get there first. Obviously, China has huge production capability when it comes to making vaccines. Hundreds of millions of vaccines are produced in China every year. So if China doesn't get there first, but the Americans have a vaccine, do you think there's scope for China to collaborate with them to start producing en masse vaccines so they can get it out to every country sort of equally rather than prioritizing one country at a time or bigger countries first?
Yeah, there will be very interesting dimensions and tensions being drawn out by that, I think, because even China's manufacturing capability is probably not enough to vaccinate billions of people around the world all at once. So who do you prioritise first and which countries do you prioritise? Or perhaps, as the WHO would like to do, health workers first in each country and then the elderly and then everyone else. I think in China there might be a bit of domestic pushback if it is seen that there's a phrase in Chinese called elbows turning outwards. It's an accusation often levied at the Chinese government that they give preferential treatment to foreigners than to their own, which I know to us in the West might sound a bit bizarre given that's not the way we see China, but you know, in this coronavirus pandemic, you've seen there have been local interest stories where foreigners in quarantine have had better treatment from local officials than Chinese nationals, and that's caused social media kerfuffle. So if it is seen that China, for scoring geopolitical points, is vaccinating America, then that could be a difficult position for the Chinese government to be in domestically as well. On the other hand, if they don't share their vaccine, you know, it would be a terrible look given that, as you say, they are one of the leading manufacturers with capability of doing this. It's all incredibly difficult, I think. I suspect that a lot of people in government are going to cross that bridge when it comes to it and not necessarily have a plan just yet.
Yeah, well, even for a small country like New Zealand, New Zealand's just put around $40 million into what everyone was sort of hoping was joining the race to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, but they've actually said, no, we don't have the capability to do that. It's too expensive. But what we are going to do is try and build our own manufacturing capability in the fear that the vaccine geopolitics will interfere with us getting it quickly. So they want to at least have the ability to manufacture a vaccine here, get the raw ingredients, get the intellectual property, hopefully through the WHO, actually get it to New Zealand and start producing it. That's something we haven't done for major vaccines like flu vaccines. It's only for niche animal vaccines in New Zealand at the moment. So that would be a great leap forward for us. And in the meantime, we're funneling some cash to some of the big players around the world just so we can say, hey, don't forget us down here. We helped you with a bit of funding to create this thing and get a shipment to us as soon as possible once you've nailed it.
And Cindy, Peter's point there is an important one, isn't it? That trust has really eroded, not simply between countries in certain circumstances, but just about supply chains and world trade. People are worried now if they can't mass manufacture vaccines, PPE, all kinds of different things in their own country, on their own soil. And this is a very different attitude to the hyper-globalization take that we all were so focused on just months ago. Do you think there's going to be a trust issue with China if they do get this vaccine still, that countries like the USA in particular, but even perhaps in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, others might simply say, you know what, we can't rely on this?
I think there will be so much domestic pressure in these countries to at least properly consider a vaccine developed by China that it will be a live conversation. I would hope that no country would rule any vaccine from China out of hand just because it is from China, considering how much of a problem the pandemic is. And I would hope that there would be real efforts to evaluate and assess the efficacy of these vaccines. And obviously, if these countries deem them not effective enough, then that is another conversation. But just because they come from China, I think would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And supply chains is something you've written about so brilliantly, Kate, in the magazine, that I think we are seeing that, like in New Zealand and in the UK as well, domestic vaccine manufacturers where previously haven't really been developed are now being fast-tracked. And I think this is a real moment, a shift in the world of what we know.
Cindy, thank you so much for that update. And now let's move over to New Zealand. Peter, thank you so much for joining us, especially with the time difference. I know you're up quite late. You've picked out a story from the New Zealand Herald this week, but before we get to that, can you give our listeners just a broad update about where New Zealand is at with its battle with COVID-19? I know we've had reports now that two new cases have been imported from the UK, actually. But apart from that, New Zealand has been boasting that it is more or less COVID-free, that community transitions apart from this import have been zero. So tell us what's going on in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, as you say, you know, it's basically 25 days since we had a reported case of COVID-19. So we have zero active cases at the moment. And that's essentially two cycles of the virus life cycle now, so which is when epidemiologists are saying we can with confidence say that we've eliminated it. There's definitely no community transmission happening anymore, the scientists say. So the big risk now for us is reintroduction of the virus through people coming through our borders. And the worry now is that we're going to get reintroduction, and the worst case scenario is a super spreader event where someone either comes through the border and through lapses in quarantine, infects someone at a hotel or even at customs on the way through the border. And then those people go out, go to a rock concert and spread it. Because just this weekend, we had the first major mass events happening again, 43,000 people at the big provincial rugby game that was held on Sunday. So that was, you know, the first time we've seen tens of thousands of people gathering. We've seen the Black Lives Matter marches here in New Zealand as well, thousands of people going to those. So it would be a nightmare scenario. Sure.
Peter, a lot of people listening to this podcast are going to be envious to hear about what you can do in New Zealand, going to mass gatherings and rugby matches and the rest. That's still very much off limits in places like the UK and elsewhere. But there may be a catch. There are some vulnerabilities in New Zealand. And the story that you flagged in the New Zealand Herald talks about a certain regulation for business being rolled back related to contact tracing that people are concerned might make the country slightly more vulnerable to an increase in infection rates. So talk us through it.
Obviously, now we're at level one. We're in this bubble, isolated at the bottom of the world on our own. And we need to open up now for the sake of our economy. We're a trading nation. Tourism is our largest industry. At the moment, we only have domestic tourism that's barely just started again. We have a national carrier, Air New Zealand, that goes all around the world. It's one of the top rated airlines in the world. But at the moment, its revenue is 5% of what it normally does, so it cannot last. You know, if we want to save our national carrier, if we want to save our tourism industry, we have to do something. So the next thing we're working towards here is opening up this trans-Tasman bubble with Australia. And it's taking a bit of time because the Australians are not really all at the same stage in terms of COVID-19. There's a state-based system there, so Victoria and New South Wales and South Australia are all at slightly different stages, and they need to sort of be on the same page and happy with travel between each other's states before they open this bubble with New Zealand. But the key thing to making a system like that work is if we do get people slipping through the cracks, as we probably will, we need to be able to contact trace those people particularly well. And this is an area where we really, not necessarily have dropped the ball, but we just haven't developed it quickly enough. We have a contact tracing app out there, but it's tied very much to businesses, restaurants, retailers, that sort of thing. And since we've moved to level one, everyone has just stopped using it. And there's no mandated requirement for people to keep using that contact tracing app. So everyone's forgotten about that. Everyone's very quickly gone back to business as usual. So we don't really have a great digital system set up for contact tracing. So that's a real priority. They say they're working on it, something that might be Bluetooth based. They're even talking about giving people a sort of Bluetooth based credit card sized card that they can slip into their wallet when they come into the country. And as they walk past people, they detect other people around them through Bluetooth. And that might be a solution. But it's a bit like the UK and lots of other countries have developed these systems, but uptake is very low. So how do we ensure we get good uptake here so that it's actually a useful solution if we do get a super spreader? Layered on top of things here, we have a real aversion, I think, to being tracked in general. So we don't have a national ID number for every Kiwi like they do in Singapore. They're a lot more comfortable about that sort of thing. So the government, I think, has been a little bit leery so far of using a solution that would be very effective from a health point of view, but from a privacy point of view, people might reject. So I think we need to get real about that if we want to avoid a second wave of COVID as we start letting more people into the country.
There is a parallel here in the UK, which has also had to very quickly build its own contact tracing system. However, the UK doesn't sound as far along, actually, from what you're saying, as New Zealand is. The app, which was supposed to be off the ground weeks ago, has still not been rolled out because the trials on the Isle of Wight have not gone as well as they had hoped. And even the contact tracing that's done by individuals seems to have a lot of people falling through the cracks. So I think there is concern right now about what that means for COVID-19 and the UK's ability to open up, which is much further behind New Zealand in terms of rebooting its economy. But I think the bigger concern, and Peter, let me know if it's true in New Zealand as well, is what if this isn't up and running by next winter or by early next year? If there could be a big second or third wave coming our way with COVID-19, if these vaccines that Cindy was talking about in her story don't pan out, we do need systems in place that mean that we don't have to go into a full lockdown again, because that would just be economically disastrous.
Absolutely. Without decent contact tracing, you know, we're in serious trouble, because we will get more cases. Even in a small isolated country like New Zealand, we're going to open up to Australia, then the islands, and we've got Kiwis coming back. Something will go wrong, and we need to be able to contact trace. And we're in unprecedented times, so when it comes to concerns around privacy and that sort of thing, I think we need to get real about it. The one that the government has put out has around 560,000 people have downloaded it, which for a small country, we're, you know, 5 million people here, isn't bad. But really, they're talking about you need 40-60% of the population using these contact tracing apps for them to be effective. So if they want to build off that base of this app, which is pretty basic at the moment, it just registers you when you go into a business, into a restaurant or something like that. The next step is automating all of that, because we only have in New Zealand like 300 or 400 people who are geared up to do contact tracing, literally hitting the phones, calling people, trying to track down contacts of people who are infected. So that's not going to work if we get a second wave. If we get, as we had here at the start of this thing, we had 5 or 6 clusters which are responsible for pretty much all of the deaths that have happened in New Zealand. Once one of those gets going, it's really difficult to make sure you can track everyone down.
Peter, why do you think that uptake has been so low? Is it a behavioural thing that people are now quite lax about the idea of a second wave, that they think that life has gone back to normal? Or is it a technical issue? So in the UK, we've heard, for example, that these apps are quite draining on your phone battery, and so it's just not practical.
Yeah, it's definitely not from a technical point of view, because we haven't yet had the features introduced to the official New Zealand app that potentially could drain your battery faster. So it's not constantly looking for Bluetooth or location data. At the moment, it's essentially a database with a form and a QR code system. That's all it really is. But the crucial thing, I think, was that they got the government app out slightly after all of this proliferation of other apps appeared. So if I, during lockdown, went into, say, Subway or McDonald's, they all had their own apps. There was probably about 2 dozen or 3 dozen of these apps. Every place I went into, it was a different experience. Most of them were based around QR codes, and there's not a really a culture of QR codes in New Zealand, which is different to, for instance, Hong Kong or China or Singapore, where they use QR codes for everything. But here, we don't really have that culture. We're still probably a little bit further behind when it comes to mobile payments and that sort of thing. So I think it's a mix of that they were just probably literally a week too slow in getting this out. So people got fatigued by this proliferation of apps. And then ultimately we went very quickly to level one. So just a lot of apathy has set in, which I think could come back to really bite us in the butt if we do have something in the next few months where we've basically cast aside all of this rigorous behavior that was instilled in us very successfully by the Prime Minister. I just fear that it's all ebbed away, that resilience we have, unless we have these systems in place that can very quickly come into action when we do start letting people back through the border.
I have to say, it's fascinating to listen to where New Zealand is at with this crisis because, well, as you point out, Peter, there are many hurdles to still overcome. It is so far ahead of where the UK is at. The article that I've chosen in the Sunday Times this week reads in its headline, "Back to School, 3 months of farce that have left our kids in chaos." We're in a very concerning situation now where the government has actually U-turned on its decision to get primary school kids back to school before the end of term. Now it looks like many of these kids won't be returning till September. And there are big question marks as to what has happened to many of these children in these roughly now 3 months of lockdown. Early studies from other countries suggest that this could have a really big financial impact on their future earnings as they go through life. And certainly when it comes to social mobility, we could be looking at a wipeout of years of hard work. Peter and Cindy, I'd be interested to hear from the different parts of the world that you're looking at this week, what the attitude is towards education and whether or not it's been prioritized in a way that it actually hasn't been prioritized here in the UK. Quite surprisingly so. Obviously, there has been pushback from the teachers' unions here. It isn't so simple as to say that the government didn't prioritize it. I do think they tried to, but they have lost the battle, certainly on this side of the summer.
Yeah, look, we've seen similar issues here in terms of what you could call the digital divide really being exposed by COVID-19. A few years ago, we invested billions in this country in creating a national fiber broadband network. Almost everyone now can get really high quality broadband, which sounds like a great thing. And it definitely, if we hadn't made that investment, we would be in serious trouble now in terms of small businesses and that being able to operate during lockdown. But there are still pockets of people in New Zealand, particularly in the Maori and Pacific Island communities, lower socioeconomic areas, like South Auckland, the biggest Polynesian community in the world, low take-up of broadband there. So I think that is a problem. Having said that, I think the transition to online learning during lockdown was actually pretty good here in New Zealand. But it was, you know, a relatively short period of time compared to some other countries that the kids are out for literally could be half a year, which is hugely disruptive. So what we've seen is 80 to 90% of kids have gone back. There is a small group of kids who haven't gone back and they're still trying to figure out why, you know, not hearing from parents as to why that is the case. And I think what a lot of people are putting it down to is just a fear of them contracting COVID-19 at school. And it sort of goes to what is still a bit of a vein of resistance in New Zealand society. You might call it anti-vaxxer sentiment, where some parents are still really worried about getting vaccines. Their solution to their kids staying healthy is to just isolate them from other kids when there's a pandemic. So they'd like to keep their kids at home and keep homeschooling them. So I think we are going to see some cases emerge off the last sort of 3 or 4% trying to get them back to school, and it's going to be a struggle. But to be honest, the bigger issue here at the moment is in tertiary education, because there's a massive industry here, foreign students coming to New Zealand, paying $50,000 or $60,000 a year to study in New Zealand, and the universities have become reliant on these people as a source of revenue, and that's completely shut off at the moment. We're about to go into semester two in the university system in New Zealand, and the universities are desperate. They're saying, if we can't get these students here for the start of semester two, they'll just cancel their placements and their bookings and they'll go somewhere else, and that's billions of dollars in revenue at stake. So they're desperate to get these people back here and studying. It's interesting that applications for later in the year and next year are up, so a lot of people are looking at New Zealand as sort of a safe harbor place to study. So they might get a bit of a boost out of this in the midterm, but in the short term, they're bleeding cash and they're saying we're going to have to lay off academics and cut our faculty programs unless we can get that revenue flowing.
That's really interesting, Peter, that one of the prizes for tackling COVID early and eliminating community transmission is that you get an increase in applications because people see it as a safe place to study and also hopefully a place that wouldn't have to lock down again. A lot of university students are missing out on social experiences as well as academic experiences. I think the UK is also very concerned about its foreign students. The universities here are also heavily reliant on their tuition fees, often to subsidize kids who are coming locally. Cindy?
In terms of primary and secondary schools, China has been reopening the schools since April, but because it's such a large country, it has not had a national approach to this. Beijing has been one of the places that has had the most draconian laws, not least because it is home to the rather elderly leaders of the Communist Party. So they really do need to be cocooned, and they've cocooned the entire city as a result of that. In China, there's an interesting tension where you've got the tug and pull of two really deep-rooted instincts. One is public health, you know, the idea that you're not just going to recover from a cold by yourself, you need to be perfectly healthy all the time. And that's why coronavirus has been so terrifying for a lot of Chinese people, is because even if you recover, there's talk of lung scarring or future implications for things like fertility or whatever it is. On the other hand, you've got the Chinese seeing education as so incredibly important that, you know, it is the home of tiger mums and battery farm secondary schools where kids literally are in school for 12 hours plus a day. So how do you balance those two? And I think reluctantly is the answer that a lot of parents have been sending their children back to school, and rather competitively as well. If you know your neighbours are sending their children back to school, you're not going to want your kids to be missing out. Because of that, as you say, Kate, Britain is starting to see, which is this social mobility effect, this inequality that's coming out. So I think Chinese parents are very competitive about that sort of thing, but it is a difficult time for them at the moment. I think a lot of Chinese students as well don't have the access to electronic learning that Western countries, developed countries have, whether it's schools being able to put stuff online or just children themselves having the actual hardware to do that. The one saving grace, though, is that China is a very smartphone-heavy country. Peter mentioned before the country's ease with using QR codes. China, for many years now, has been relying on smartphones. They skipped computers and skipped credit cards. People have been using their smartphones to pay and get around society. And so you're seeing some schoolwork being distributed just via software on your phones, and children have that as well. Today it was meant to be the primary schools reopening in Beijing, but they've had to pause that for now because of this potential second wave in Beijing that I mentioned earlier in the episode, where they've had no new cases for the last 50 days, and then over the last 4 days they've had over 70 cases, and all linked to another seafood market. So God forbid that it is actually another second wave, but it has put a stop on local schools again.
It's becoming increasingly clear that we're just not going to know the full impact of keeping schools closed for 3 months, 6 months, potentially longer, and what that means for social mobility, income, and even the mental health of these kids. I do fear that the outcome can only be negative for some time at least, but we'll be keeping a close eye on it here in the UK. And now to move from one country's worries to another country's worries, we are joined by Jennifer Creary in Hong Kong. Now, some listeners of Coronomics have asked me how exactly we do these recordings, because we have guests from all over the world in different time zones speaking to each other in real time. And while sometimes it has been a struggle, we usually just about pull it off. But because we got to have Peter on the podcast this week in New Zealand, we have had to break this one up. So Peter has left us. A big thanks to Peter. And now Cindy and I are joined by Jennifer. Jennifer, the story that you've picked out is published on the Hong Kong Free Press where you work, but it's been taken from the AFP, and it's highlighting the airline industry in Hong Kong and the bailout and what that means politically. It's very interesting, though, that you had to dig for this story, didn't you? Because coronavirus is not at the top of Hong Kong's agenda anymore. So can you give us a broad update as to what the situation with the virus is in Hong Kong, and then dive into the story?
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting because coronavirus has taken a back seat in Hong Kong because we have our own political crisis at the moment, a national security law which Beijing is set to impose in the city. So it really hasn't been on the forefront of the news agenda. Every now and then you kind of get an article saying that there are X many cases or maybe no cases at all in the city. And so you're kind of reminded about that, and most people are wearing masks, but it isn't so much a pervasive fear anymore. So it was interesting trying to find a story about the coronavirus, something that wasn't explicitly related to national security legislation. So it was a bit of a task, but the one I want to talk about today is about Cathay Pacific, and so that's Hong Kong's flagship carrier, and it's a really interesting example of how government financial assistance during the economic downturn caused by the coronavirus raises questions over political influence and whether or not it's possible for political entities to throw private companies a sort of lifeline with no strings attached. So, of course, the aviation industry has been hit really hard by the drop in the number of travellers. I think Cathay alone recorded a decline of upwards of maybe 79% per month, which is huge considering that the airline controls around 50% of all runway slots at Hong Kong International Airport. And the city itself, as a financial hub, relies pretty heavily on international travel and global connectivity. As you can imagine, this airline occupies a pretty significant place in the aviation industry, in not just Hong Kong, but the region at large. The government announced a 39 billion Hong Kong dollar bailout. I think that's around 5 billion USD. And the article does highlight that this is the first time a government has injected money and taken direct stake in a private company. And essentially how this will happen is that the bulk of the capital will come from shares bought by a newly created company owned by the government called Aviation 2020, as well as a 7.8 billion Hong Kong dollar bridge loan. But most notably, the government will be able to send in two so-called observers from this new company, Aviation 2020, to attend board meetings. And these individuals will reportedly be, quote, professionals, not officials. The financial secretary has said that these observers won't be involved in the day-to-day operations of the airline. For example, they won't have any voting rights, but they will have a say in the company's corporate affairs, which has really sounded the alarm for many because, despite government assurances, influence seems to be kind of inevitable given the sheer presence of these appointees. But it's really interesting to note the backdrop of how the airline was embroiled in last year's protests, and this is really significant, I think. Cathay relies heavily on the mainland Chinese market, and it came under intense scrutiny from Beijing after, as the article notes, some of its employees had expressed support for the city's pro-democracy movement. And there were some pretty high-profile cases of pilots and a union leader being fired after expressing their political opinions. The union leader, most notably, posted a status on Facebook, and then one of her friends called her out, and as a result, she lost her job. And this was pretty well reported. And you know, employees were complaining of this climate of so-called white terror, and there were several solidarity marches in support of them. And this all culminated in the resignation of its CEO and chairman. By the time the coronavirus hit, the company was already suffering a pretty huge decline in the number of travellers. You know, Hong Kong's economic situation was pretty dire due to a combination of factors, but notably the US-China trade war and the anti-government protests. So Cathay was just hemorrhaging money at around a rate of, I think, 2.5 to 3 billion Hong Kong dollars per month. So the government justification for this bailout is that it's not so much about Cathay, but just the aviation industry at large, and as a result, the economic health of the city. I think it was pro-Beijing lawmaker Regina Ip who said that Cathay is just too big to not bail out. But the article rightly notes that this isn't a problem exclusive to Hong Kong. Many other airlines in different areas of the world are, of course, suffering because of the travel restrictions. But I think the political context behind what's happening in Hong Kong is quite interesting. There's plenty of skepticism over whether or not this bailout will have a huge impact on the company's long-term outlook, but certainly for the time being, it's a short-term remedy.
So interesting, Jennifer, because here in the UK, we're talking a lot about the airline industry as well, and there are attempts to secure bailouts for them, although the industry is very much having a standoff with the government at the moment. We're not sure who's going to win in that battle yet. But the focus is, of course, on jobs and on business security and whether or not they can survive through COVID. Whereas it sounds like in Hong Kong, your debate is political as well, but for very, very different reasons now, showing how much faster Hong Kong has moved past at least the first wave of COVID-19 that has gone back to talking about its politics from 6 months ago, a year ago. Whereas the UK can't really fathom that yet. And I think a lot of countries just can't imagine a scenario where the political discussion doesn't somehow revolve around COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it does revolve around that too, because as the article rightly notes, there are some 33,000 employees employed by Cathay. There is talk of executive salaries being cut, more unpaid leave being so-called offered to staff, and job cuts seem almost inevitable, or they're definitely possible. That is a focus, of course, but with a lot of things in Hong Kong, it revolves around politics. You've got to remember that the political crisis last year wasn't really solved. Although it was sparked by this extradition bill, which was suspended and then withdrawn, there were deep underlying conflicts within society, between the government, between police, that it's going to take a long time to heal. And the current political situation is only really getting worse with the introduction of the national security legislation. So for even, you know, pieces of news like Cathay is ultimately going to be embroiled in politics somehow, especially when it comes to government intervention.
Cindy? Jennifer, the Cathay example is incredibly interesting because, as you say, this is the company that got into so much trouble with Beijing last year over the Hong Kong protests. I remember I was going via Hong Kong into mainland China at the end of the summer last year, and I rather cheekily asked an air hostess on my Cathay flight what she meant of it all. That was just after the airport sit-in by the protesters, when Cathay was starting to have its employees sort of sacked for their support for the protests. And she obviously very understandably didn't want to talk about it at all. So it was just a very sensitive time for her and for the company. I wonder how you evaluate the position and the tensions that big companies like Cathay, and the other example that comes to mind is HSBC, have to deal with in Hong Kong, given that they are too often sort of squeezed between Beijing and Hong Kong. HSBC, of course, as listeners know, has recently come out in support of the national security law that Beijing is proposing to put in. What is it like to be a big company in these political times?
This is definitely a pertinent question, because also a bit of context, there's this division in Hong Kong over, you know, small businesses as well as large companies, whether or not they are so-called yellow ribbon or blue ribbon, yellow being the colour of the pro-democracy movement, blue being pro-government, pro-Beijing supporters. And there was an underlying emphasis on companies to express their political opinions, and there were apps that could direct users to so-called yellow-friendly businesses to basically direct money their way. And because Hong Kong is just so connected to the mainland financially, it puts companies in a very difficult position. And as you were saying, with the example of HSBC, which is, of course, headquartered in London, but its head released a statement expressing support for national security legislation. And more importantly, this was after the former chief executive, Leung Chun-Yin, posted a status saying, you know, why hasn't HSBC said anything about this? So there seems to be kind of this underlying pressure, and you can see this in the way in which companies express themselves. And certainly businesses, you know, small and large in Hong Kong are feeling the pressure. Companies with so-called pro-government or pro-Beijing sympathies have been targeted by protesters. They've been targets of vandalism. The same goes for so-called yellow pro-democracy businesses. They've also been targeted by pro-government supporters. And so it swings both ways. But I think certainly with the introduction of national security legislation, it's probably only going to get worse.
Jennifer, before he got off the call, Peter also wanted to ask you this question about Hong Kong.
So, Jennifer, it's remarkable the progress that Hong Kong has made. Only 4 fatalities in a country of over 7 million people. That's incredibly impressive. Unlike New Zealand, you're actually on the doorstep of the most populous country in the world. So we're very isolated here. Easier for us to keep our borders locked down. What is actually happening in Hong Kong at the border level to actually make sure that you don't get those cases slipping through, maybe quarantine where it's a little bit more lax than it should be, and these potential super spreaders are emerging into Hong Kong?
So as we've spoken about in previous podcasts, Hong Kong has been able to track anyone entering the city by essentially putting them into a mandatory 14-day quarantine. And it's relaxed some of the travel restrictions between Hong Kong and the mainland by allowing, you know, certain business travelers to come through, ensuring that they don't have to enter quarantine twice, because there are some parts of the mainland where you have to enter the quarantine too. There have been instances of community outbreaks. Most notably, recently, a woman was confirmed to have the virus, and then her husband was also confirmed, and also several of her co-workers. And so there was a fear of there being a super spreader. But the Centre for Health Protection has been pretty good in contact tracing and ensuring that anyone who does have contact with confirmed cases goes into quarantine and gets medical attention. And so, as you rightly said, it's pretty remarkable that Hong Kong has been able to keep its numbers so low, but it has been slow in relaxing its restrictions. So the government still has the restriction on public gatherings to no more than 8 people. And so it's taking a relatively cautious approach. And actually recently, for the first time in 30 years, a huge candlelight vigil to commemorate victims of the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown was banned by police, which cited the coronavirus public gathering restriction. So that's pretty huge. But the government justification for it is that it's for public health reasons, and that it's going to take a pretty conservative approach when it comes to relaxing those restrictions.
Jennifer, lastly, if I may, is there any talk yet in Hong Kong about how priority and focus must shift again if a second wave looks likely or indeed becomes inevitable? Or is the focus right now really hunkered down for obvious reasons in the security law and the tensions with mainland China? Because it strikes me that in many countries, the ebb and flow of focus on coronavirus is going to become an inevitability. As other kinds of politics picks up, it's going to be something that's in the spotlight and also wanes. Where do you think Hong Kong is right now with its journey on that?
The government has adopted a so-called suppress and lift strategy, which it's a term it uses to characterize the relaxing of restrictions when it seems to be pretty calm and the tightening of restrictions when there's a flare-up, like a community outbreak. And so it seems like there's no like long-term plan for the time being. It's certainly, in terms of economic pressure, financial pressure, it needs to relax some restrictions. You know, with the example of Cathay, this of course isn't a long-term solution. They will need to generate money somehow pretty soon. But for the time being, the government's strategy is to essentially wait and see. If there aren't many community outbreaks in the future, then of course they will relax restrictions. But with the political tensions, there's always skepticism over what the government will do next. So for example, if they do maintain this restriction on public gatherings, many critics will say that it's for political purposes because they're trying to suppress any large-scale gathering. So it seems the government so far is taking a cautious approach and is very much waiting to see what will happen next in terms of the virus.
Jennifer and Cindy, thank you so much for joining me, and a big thank you to Peter, who was on earlier in this podcast. To hear more from journalists around the world in next week's episode of Coronomics, subscribe to our podcast channel, Spectator Radio. And if you're listening in America, you can subscribe to The Spectator at spectator.us/subscribe using the promo code KATE for a discount.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.